But the pilgrims knew that anyone who climbed those stairs, the Scala Sancta, on his or her knees, saying a Pater Noster on each one, could release a soul from purgatory. The bodies of Peter and Paul supposedly were distributed among several churches in Rome. When Luther began traveling around the city, he became dismayed almost immediately because Rome was far from holy.
Welcome to Let the Bible Speak. This is Ian Gollaher, and you have just been listening to Reverend David Mook, who was preaching in our church on Reformation, and we're going to have that message loud and clear here on the program today. Firstly, a little thought from our Bible study notes in Genesis. I want to encourage you to get our Bible study notes each week. We have this study that is suitable for home, for family, for the individual, or for a group setting, and these are available on our website, or you can sign up on our newsletter and you'll get them on the inbox of your weekly email. So let's turn to Genesis chapter 1, that great chapter of, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. This text is fundamental to the whole book of Genesis as the book of beginnings, and to the whole Bible as God's revelation to man. It gives a true foundation to the history of the world and of mankind. And this is the battleground between God's revelation and man's reason, or between faith in God's word and so-called science. God has spoken of his own work of creation. We are not left to speculate how the earth originated, nor how we originated. All we need to do is read the book of Genesis. Now, I want to come to the purpose of this passage in the first chapter. You will find here that this is to declare God's creation of the world out of nothing, ex nihilo, and its organization into a perfect world in six literal 24-hour days. There's no other way to read this. These are solar days. The Hebrew word yom, that is consistently used for the 24-hour period. It also declares man's creation in God's image, and how man was given dominion over the creatures. This is vital information to know about God, about the world that he has created, and about man's origin and purpose of life. The knowledge of God as the creator and man as creature is imperative to our fellowship with the true and living God. It was the Apostle Paul's starting point when teaching the Athenians who were worshipping the unknown God. In Acts 17, 22-31, you'll find that the Apostle Paul took great time and effort to explain who the true God is. He is the creator of the world. So we leave it there, but we invite you to get a copy of these notes. Genesis, God's Book of Beginnings, and you can go to our website, www.cloverdalefpc.ca, or just ltbs.ca, and go to Resources, Bible Study Notes, and you'll find these chapter by chapter, study by study. They're in PDF format. You can print them out and use them as you can. So I trust you'll do that. Now we're coming to our message today, to the word on the Protestant Reformation. These are the times when we want to remember what God did through Martin Luther, and how on that occasion when he nailed those protests to the church door at Wittenberg, how he stirred the hearts of Germans to seek the liberty of the gospel. And that was the stirring that shook the world. Indeed, Martin Luther is often referred to as the monk who shook the world. So stay tuned as we turn now to the preaching of the Reverend Dave Mook, who is our Free Presbyterian minister in Phoenix, Arizona, preaching here in our church on Martin Luther and the German Reformation.
In 1510, after a journey by foot that took 5 months, Martin Luther saw Rome. It would be his only trip outside of the German lands in his life. The 27-year-old Augustinian monk and a brother monk from the cloister at Erfurt bore special commissions from the head of their order that required the attention of the Pope. Their business would take a month to complete, and while they were there, they did see Pope Julius II complete in body armor, riding on a horse through the streets of Rome. And in that one sighting of him, they understood why it was that he was called the warrior pope. The thought of Luther's superiors was that the journey to Rome, to which they assigned him, would distract him from all his personal problems. And so, like so many pilgrims before him, he made his journey. And like so many pilgrims before him, he probably exclaimed when the spires of the eternal city came into view, "Hail, holy Rome!" However, the reputation of Rome far exceeded the city's actual appearance and life. There were, of course, in the city the remnants of Rome's imperial past. And for those ruins, Luther had very little interest. He didn't care to see them. Because like other pilgrims making their journey to Rome, he wanted to see and venerate as many of the holy relics as possible. The church of St. Callistus alone contained the bodies of 40 popes and the remains of 76,000 martyrs from imperial times. Now, if you want to know how they knew there were that many, I couldn't answer that question. In addition, there was, to describe just a few other of the relics, a piece of Moses' burning bush, the chains that supposedly bound Paul, and a coin that Judas received for betraying the Lord Jesus by visiting the two churches of St. John the Lateran and St. Peter's. Pilgrims could achieve more indulgences than they could if they took a trip to the Holy Land. Now, located in front of St. John the Lateran were, as the church testified, the very 28 stairs that at one time stood outside the palace of Pontius Pilate in Jerusalem. Now, how such an imposing architectural object could have been moved from Jerusalem to Rome and fitted into just that space, no one ever ventured to say. But the pilgrims knew that anyone who climbed those stairs, the Scala Sancta, on his or her knees, saying a Pater Noster on each one, could release a soul from purgatory. The bodies of Peter and Paul supposedly were distributed among several churches in Rome. When Luther began traveling around the city, he became dismayed almost immediately because Rome was far from holy. He witnessed the scandalous lives of the priests who made no secret of their visits to houses of ill repute. The indifference of the priests astonished him. They could say seven masses in the time it took Luther to say one. In fact, some of them would say, "Come on, get a move on, hurry up." Some of the priests made a mockery of the doctrine of transubstantiation by saying of the elements of the Eucharist, "Bread thou art, and bread thou shalt remain, wine thou art, and wine thou shalt remain." But for Martin Luther, the critical moment proved to be his own climb of the Scala Sancta. He repeated the Paternoster on each step, climbing on his knees and kissing each step for good measure, hoped to release his grandfather from purgatory. In fact, he said he wished that his own parents were already in purgatory so that he could release them as well. But when he reached the top of the stairs, he rose and looked down the steps up which he had climbed and said, "Who knows if it is so?" And in that doubtful frame of mind, Luther returned back across the miles he had traveled to Erfurt. The deliverance he hoped to gain by his journey turned into still greater misery. But just a little more than 7 years later, Martin Luther, just over a week before his 34th birthday, took an action that sparked a movement of sweeping spiritual power and that shattered the myth of medieval Romanism. That scene on the eve of All Saints' Day in 1517, that was 500 years ago this last Tuesday, became a favorite theme for portrayers of the Protestant Reformation. The determined professor of law and theology at the University of Wittenberg sought a debate with his colleagues on the faculty about the Roman Church's doctrine of indulgences. And so, with a list of 95 proposals for debate in his hand, he prepared to post them in the typical manner on the door of the church. Now, at that day, there was no intent in his mind to create a movement. He desired simply that the church should take steps to curb the abuses of the indulgence trade. That was his intention. But that moment became one of history's great hinges. It was a turning point. The transition from the medieval world to the modern world. The transition from life in bondage to life in liberty. Because in that scene, we observe Luther before the church door. Luther before the church door. All Saints' Day, which was November the 1st, was the day in the year reserved for all the saints who lacked a specific day in their honor. So All Saints' Day was November the 1st. So if there was a saint that did not have a specific day on a calendar in the year, because every other day there was a day for the saint. If you were a saint that didn't have a specific day, then you and everybody else like that got lumped into that one day. That was All Saints' Day. In Wittenberg, it was the day each year when the Elector of Saxony, Frederick the Wise, directed that the castle church doors be opened to admit the faithful, to venerate the impressive collection of supposed relics. In the collection, in which Frederick invested a lot of wealth, there was what the church certified was an actual thorn from the crown that pierced Christ's brow. Roland Bainton described other parts of the collection in this way: one tooth from St. Jerome, of St. Chrysostom, four pieces, of St. Bernard, six, and of St. Augustine, four. Of Our Lady, four hairs, three pieces of her cloak, four from her girdle, and seven from the veil sprinkled with the blood of Christ. The relics of Christ included one piece from his swaddling clothes, 13 from his crib, one wisp of straw, one piece of the gold brought by the wise men, and three of the myrrh, one strand of Jesus' beard, one of the nails driven into his hands, one piece of bread eaten at the Last Supper, one piece of the stone on which Jesus stood to ascend into heaven, and one twig of Moses' burning bush. Now, there is a tendency for people who hear such a list now to smile, perhaps even to laugh out loud. But I assure you, for people in that time, it was not a laughing matter. They were taught that these things were true relics. And by 1520, those who visited the church on All Saints' Day and made, this was the important part, the required cash contributions, could receive from the Pope indulgences, either for themselves or for others, that would provide a reduction in the time in purgatory in the amount of 1,902,202 years and 270 days. They had it figured out to the very day. This was the amount of indulgences that you could receive. Now, Luther took a very dim view of that aspect of the indulgence trade. He had spoken against it. But what brought him to the church door on October 31st, 1517, All Hallows Eve, if you kept saying it fast enough, it would become simply Hallows Eve, Hallows Eve, Halloween. Halloween. That's what it's called now. But what brought him there was the sale of plenary indulgences in the neighboring territory. From the aftermath of his visit to Rome in 1510, Martin Luther began a journey on which his superiors placed him, thinking they were going to do something to save him for the church, but unwittingly placing him on the path that led in a much different direction, a path that would mark the irretrievable rupture of all that the Roman Church spent centuries to consolidate. The journey passed through four distinct phases that brought Martin Luther to the correct understanding of the words of our text this evening, particularly those words, "The just shall live by faith." He had to find out what that meant. So I want you to consider with me those phases this evening, and they each begin with the letter D. The first phase, despair. Despair. Luther's journey to Rome in 1510 came in the middle of a serious spiritual crisis for the young monk. You see, unlike many of the other monks, Luther actually took seriously all that he was supposed to do in the monastery. There were other monks who said, "Martin, you're too much. You're taking it too seriously." But he was a careful student of the methods by which medieval religion provided ways of escape from the dread of the afterlife. And if you had lived in that time, you would have been familiar with some images, woodcuts primarily, from that period that showed in very lurid fashion the prospects that awaited people on their deaths. And in some of those images, Christ himself appeared as an avenging, implacable judge who ordered that those who did not merit entrance into heaven should be banished, dragged away to hell. And only the interposition of the Blessed Virgin Mary, people were taught, could have any success in alleviating the wrath of her son. When Martin Luther returned from his trip to Rome, he felt the discouragement and the disappointment at having discovered that the epithet Holy Rome was a monstrous lie. There was nothing holy about it. He felt himself left very much alone, even in the midst of the other monks, in his quest to find the path to the forgiveness of sins, of his sins. At one point, John Staupitz, one of Luther's superiors in the Augustinian order, confronted him about the situation. And he asked Luther whether he believed in the forgiveness of sins. And Luther said, "The fathers have taught it. Of course I believe it." Staupitz then asked whether Luther believed in the forgiveness of Martin Luther's sins. And there was the issue. Because throughout most of his life, Luther suffered wild swings in his mood, sometimes being very positive and other times very gloomy. Not in the manner of those who today are diagnosed with manic depressive disorder, but times when he became very discouraged and depressed by his own failures as he sought to satisfy God. And even after his conversion to the truth of the gospel, Luther continued to have these battles. He often felt that he was unworthy to be in the presence of God. He would say, "I am dust and ashes and full of sin." He did not know how he, as an unworthy sinner, could ever approach the God who is so high and so holy. Bainton refers to this idea as his terror of the holy. He was afraid of God. He wanted to approach God. He felt attracted to God, but at the same time he felt repulsed by God because of his own unworthiness. And so Luther created a word to describe this situation for which there is no English equivalent. He called it unfectum. And it's an expression that now is in English, like one that came out of World War II, for which also there is no equivalent in English, the word blitzkrieg. Unfectum, as Bainton explained it, and this is how Luther viewed it, maybe a trial sent by God to test man, or an assault by the devil to destroy man. It is all the doubt, turmoil, pang, tremor, panic, despair, desolation, and desperation which invade the spirit of man. And that's a common affliction. No doubt there are people here who, at least at some time in their lives, have faced the same challenge. Luther felt something of the terror while he was celebrating Mass for the first time. He came to celebrate Mass, and he came to the part where he was to elevate the host and to present Christ as a sacrifice afresh for sins. And the very thought that he was offering the body of Christ up to God filled him with terror. How could he appear in that place? And it was because Luther was trying to satisfy God by all the prescribed methods. In addition, he was a monk and was so diligent in his duties as a monk that he felt he was more serious than any of his brothers in the cloister. And there was the cause of the despair, because in spite of all he did, he sensed it was not enough, and that it would never be enough, and that he could never have assurance that God accepted him.
You're listening to Let the Bible Speak, the radio broadcast of our Free Presbyterian Church. This is Pastor Ian Gollaher, and that was the Reverend David Mook preaching on the conversion of Martin Luther. And of course, that's an important story on this Reformation weekend. If you choose to go to our website, you'll find a number of articles on how Luther found peace with God, how he was jolted by his visit to Rome, how he became a preacher of the gospel at Wittenberg, and also there's an article on his misery in the monastery. These are interesting details on Martin Luther, and we invite you to join, check out our website. All the information's coming up now, and we'll be bringing part two of this message on Monday. Thank you for listening to our Let the Bible Speak broadcast. This is Ian Gollaher. If you missed part of today's program or would like to hear it again, you can find it archived by program date on our website. Just go to www.ltbs.ca. You'll also find our podcast button on the top of the homepage of our website. We are on the air Sundays 9:30 a.m., for our full church broadcast, and Monday to Friday, 5 a.m. and 5 p.m., on this station to bring you the gospel from our Free Presbyterian Church in Cloverdale. We also invite you to our church services, Sundays 10:30 and 6 p.m. Yes, we have an evening preaching service in our church at 6 p.m. Through our website, you can listen and view our church services at 10:30 and 6 p.m. Click on the Live Now button on the home page of our website. Or if you would like to talk with me one-on-one as a pastor, please give me a call. The phone number is 604-576-1091. The mailing address is 18790 58 Avenue, Surrey, BC, V3S1M6. We are located two blocks north of Number 10 Highway on 188 Street. We also have a church in Victoria, 733 Van Alman Avenue, Sundays 10:30 and 6. Our website again is www.ltbs.ca. Remember to join us here again on this station, Monday to Friday, 5 a.m. and 5 p.m. as we let the Bible speak.